That's classic from Chris Rice. It's called Smellin' Coffee. And it's 13 minutes after the hour. It is a Broken Road Radio Tuesday morning, and we're joined by Dr. Don Clark, our resident biochemist and member of the Board of Creation Moments. Don joining us from Garden Valley, Texas. Don, happy Tuesday to you.
Well, happy Tuesday to you. I see that we are missing Dave again.
And David is, yeah, David is he's not AWOL, because that's without leave. He would be all absent with leave then. Yeah, he is. He gave me
fair, it was approved leave.
It was, yeah. Yeah, he submitted his request hours ago. And so he's off and running now back to real life. But I get to play with the music and push the buttons and talk to the people, and glad to have your company this morning. In fact, every Tuesday we talk to Don, and we normally talk about scientific things, because his background is, well, downright scientific. And we learned some interesting perspectives on things like evolution and creation. And he also happens to know the Bible like the back of his hand. Is that a fair statement?
Well, not necessarily that well,
no,
but
okay.
I do. Certainly any the scriptures relating to creation and other parts, I know quite well. But the whole Bible, you know, there's sections there that I'm not as familiar with.
That bemuse and befuddle some of those sections do. Yeah, that happens to me too. Happens to me too. Well, Don is with Creation Moments. And by the way, you can link to their website from ours if you're listening on BrokenRoadRadio.com this morning. If you're listening on Live 365, you might want to switch over to BrokenRoadRadio.com. We have all those useful links. One of them is to Creation Moments. .com, where there's a wealth of resources on the science that has to do with young earth creationism. And it's science that doesn't get trumpeted very loud or by very many different people. Creation Moments is really one of the key places you can go to find out what science has to say about young earth creation. And it's enlightening and interesting. And one of the areas we get into from time to time is DNA. And we've talked about DNA many times over the last couple of years, but this story has something different about it. This is a story on AFP. It's available to you at MSN News. We'll link to it in our podcast later today on our website, so you can check it out for yourself. But this comes from a very old bone. How old can DNA be? How old does a bone have to be before it's useless for DNA?
Well, that's a good question. probably not as old as they're stating in this article, mm-hmm. Because DNA, it's a huge molecule. For example, the human genome has 3 billion base pairs, nucleotide base pairs in it, and that's quite a long chain. Of course, it's mm-hmm. broken up into the chromosomes, the 21 chromosomes that we have. So, each of the chromosomes aren't quite that long, but, I remember in the, when I was back studying biochemistry years and years ago, when we went in the lab, you had to treat DNA very, very carefully, because just stirring your solution of DNA would break it. I mean, just mm-hmm. gently stirring it with a glass stirring rod, for example, would break the molecule. So it's a it's a molecule that degrades rapidly out in the elements. But as we've know from Mark Armitage and others that have found DNA fragments, segments in, not him so much, he was looking at soft tissue, but others have found DNA segments in dinosaur soft tissue.
Mm-hmm.
So dinosaur bones, and then you, look at the soft tissue in the dinosaur bones, and not only do you find osteocytes, which is what Mark was focused on, with his electron micrographs, but you can actually get some DNA out of that. So, you can say, well, dinosaurs lived you know, 50, 60 million years ago, or if not longer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe your dating method is not correct, and those ages really, you know, there aren't really that age.
A lot of traditional science looks at Mark Armitage's findings with a jaundiced eye, because they're saying that you can't have soft tissue in something as old as 65 million years. Of course, the flip side of that argument is, well, that it's not 65 million years old, is it?
Yeah, exactly. That's his point.
Yeah.
And, of course, the folks in creation, that's our point. Of course it's not that old.
But there's
we have a different model.
Well, they're so married to the dating system and the basic assumptions that they can't conceive of anything that would contradict that. And,
right.
And so they close themselves off, and I'm thinking old Earth creationists and just old Earthers and evolutionists that don't consider the science that opposes their basic assumptions. And the first move is to ridicule the messenger when that happens. And that's kind of a sad situation. In this case, though, scientists did find a very old bone, however old is, out in Siberia. And they found some DNA in it. Tell us about this find and what it means to us. What are they trumpeting here?
Well, they found a human bone, actually, on the banks of West Siberia. It was really back in 2008, I guess they really have just reported the DNA analysis from some of the, again, soft tissue in this human bone. But the whole purpose or the emphasis of the article is that, hey, this DNA contains some Neanderthal DNA. You know, we can discuss how they know it contains Neanderthal DNA, and how much of Neanderthal DNA. We can, you know, the article doesn't go into, this is a popular article, so it doesn't go into the details of the scientific study. But they're claiming this to be one of the oldest or the oldest DNA sample ever found. Contain some Neanderthal DNA.
Well, how does science classify Neanderthals? Are they seen as human beings, or are they some kind of a pre-human species?
Well, they're considered to be a pre-human species, and so of course we can get into a long discussion about that. But the interesting thing, if they found some the Neanderthal DNA, for example, in Homo sapiens, or this bone sample, what that tells me from a creation point of view is that Homo erectus, which is the Neanderthals fall into Homo erectus, and these are just names, by the way. A classification of animals and humans, in this case, or pre-humans, or just classifications. And they do it by morphology, or phenotypic type of things. So what the animal or human might have looked like, then they may give it a different name.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because if you look at the Neanderthals, what are the major characteristics of a Neanderthal? Well, he's got furrowed brows. I mean, he's got his brows are very, very thick, so that was one of the reasons why they say, oh, this is a caveman, and he's pre-human because we don't look like this anymore. Well, you can find humans that look like that mm-hmm. have furrowed brows, and there's a fellow who actually did. He's in the creation world. He actually did some major, extensive research on the skulls and the bones of Neanderthal, and he said, "Well, you know what? These are actually just old people." His name is Jack Kuzo, and he studied these from, because he's a bone doctor, basically studied them from that point of view, and he said, you know, if we just lived as long as these dudes did, then we would look the same.
They're just aged individuals then.
Very, very old individuals. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why we don't see a lot of the old individuals anymore is because we don't live that long anymore. And the interesting thing about this particular article is that we've got, okay, we got Neanderthal and we got Homo sapiens kind of interbreeding, and they're located in Europe, Euro-Asia. This one was in Siberia. The original Neanderthals actually were described out of Germany. And so we find these folks kind of scattered in Europe, in northern Europe. The reason why this is a problem in quote traditional science is because before this they thought that everyone was a descendant out of Africa. Mm-hmm. And that conclusion was drawn based on analysis out of mitochondria, DNA analysis, mitochondrial DNA analysis, and the mitochondria are the organelles or organisms within your cell that is that produces the energy, chemical energy that you need to run everything in your cell.
So they would have said that everybody originated from African human beings. That's
right.
Where it all started. And now, does this contradict that in any way?
It completely contradicts it, because here we have a group of humans that are out of the folks that they thought out of Africa before had no, in quote, Neanderthal DNA in it. So this kind of contaminates the human line.
So Neanderthals then would have predated the African human species. Is that what we're saying?
Or they originated from a different place than Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with that in mind, let's just talk about human migration from a creation point of view. You know, and we have a very accurate biblical record of what happened to us after the flood. Of course, we have a pretty good record what happened to us before the flood and why the flood even happened. Mm-hmm. But we have in Genesis chapters 10 and 11, we have the descendants of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Both in chapter 10, which describes in quite detail.
Of course, those are Noah's sons, so.
Yeah, exactly. They're Noah's sons. They're Noah's, and so they rode with Noah, if you will, in the ark, and came out of the ark. And with the only, there were only eight people that were in the ark. There was Noah and his wife, and then Shem, Ham, and Japheth, but his three sons and their wives. So we had eight people coming out of the ark. Shem, Ham, and Japheth were then going to be the ones that were going to be fruitful and multiply and refill the earth. But something happened to their descendants, the folks, not too long after the flood. There was a fellow by the name of Nimrod, who was a mighty man, and he built some cities not too far from where from Mount Ararat in the plains of Shinar, and he then excited the people to say, "Hey, let's build a tower to ourselves. Let's not disperse across the earth." In rebellion, I might add, once again, to God's word, which said, hey, go and fill the earth. Well, if you're staying in one place, you're not going to fill the earth. But the reason why they stayed in one place is because they wanted to make a name for themselves. Mm-hmm. So they start building this tower or ziggurat, the Bible gives the great detail about, you know, they made bricks and they fired the bricks and the bricks were hard and they you know, they put the bricks together and they were building this tower. And then God comes on the scene and says, hey, wait a minute. If we don't stop these folks, then, you know, we're going to have another problem. And, of course, you know, from God's perspective, his problem is that if man congregated in one place for too long, they were going to sin, and we were going to be right back to man's thoughts being continuously evil again, and then God would have had to destroy them early. Mm-hmm. This was only, by the way, this Babel, Tower at Babel, was only 100 years past the flood. So God, in his mercy, confused the languages. So we have in the biblical record where languages came from and where they originated. Noah and his sons in families and everybody before the flood spoke one language. And here we get the confusion of the language. They can't communicate with each other. They can no longer construct the Tower of Babel. And they're literally forced to disperse, throughout the land.
So they would by and by discover who was speaking the same language. They could communicate. They would tend to coalesce and then move off to their own territory someplace.
And that's correct. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, the Bible doesn't say this, but one would anticipate in God's mercy that he would have kept family groups together. Mm-hmm. So if you were a descendant of Japheth, for example, then your particular family would more than likely speak the same language. Otherwise, God's mm-hmm. disrupting family units, which we know he is against. And so your family would disperse into one direction. Somebody else's family would disperse in another direction. Okay, so now with that in mind, the early dispersion of peoples, have a pretty good idea where they went. And so who was in Germany, for example, because that was where the original Neanderthals were found. And it's actually a descendant of Japheth. So the Japhites, if you will, descendants of Japheth, dispersed into Europe and into Russia, and then eventually into northern Asia. And then we had the Hamites who moved to Africa, for example, Egypt and Ethiopia and Libya, the way we now call Libya. Actually, one of the descendants of Ham is called Egypt.
I was going to say, you can pick this up in the genealogies that are given of the offspring of the sons of Noah. And you do recognize names of certain geographic locations in those areas. And that is where the clue comes from as to where these people went, as to how those countries were eventually named. Yeah.
And so you had, for example, that one of the, one of Japheth's, sons, direct son was Javan. And it was Javan, but that's not the one I want to talk about. But one of Japheth's sons was Gomer, and Gomer's son was Ashkenaz. And Ashkenaz, the Hebrew word for Germany is Ashkenaz. Mm-hmm. So Ashkenaz wound up, in Germany. And populated that part of Europe, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, the other interesting thing, and you can get this out of the Bible as well, is the lineage. For example, it goes through not only the genealogies of the three sons of Noah, but for Shem, for example, because Shem is important for the line of Jesus. It gives the same dating information as it did in Genesis chapter 5, for example, for descendants of Adam. So we can, we know exactly, for example, how old these folks were when they died. How old were they when they had their first child, for example, their first male? And based on putting just the dates together, and it's very easy to do, you can find out, okay, there was a descendant of Shem called Peleg, for example, and his name means division. Mm-hmm. And he was born in 101 years after the flood. And so we have a very accurate record. Of course, there's those that would scoff and say, well, how can, you know, these people, the Bible says that they lived, you know, 930, 950 years. For example, Noah lived after the flood, you know, 450 years. So Noah was, 350 years. So Noah was over, he was 950 years old, mm-hmm. When he died. And Shem, for example, was 600 years old when he died. Arphaxad, who's the descendant of Shem, is the son of Shem, lived 438 years. And Selah, which was his son, lived 433 years. And Eber, who was his son, where actually Eber, where we get the Hebrew language from, is from Eber. Mm-hmm. And so his name turned into Hebrew as we have it today. He lived 464 years. Now, if you go down the list all the way to Abram, for example, who was the son of Terah, as we know, you know, from the Bible, mm-hmm. He lived 175 years. So after the flood, the ages start dropping pretty significantly. You get out 100 years. Peleg, for example, who was born in 101, and they think the Tower of Babel, the dispersion at the Tower of Babel, was 106 years past the flood. Peleg only lived 239 years instead of the 600 years that Shem lived. Mm-hmm. So there was something different in the environment that was definitely causing these folks to have shorter and shorter lifespans. And to give you an example, Shem, for example, lived to if you take date zero as being the time of creation, he lived to 2158. Abraham, who died at 175 years old, he lived only until 2123. So Shem outlived his 9, you know, his great 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 great, you know, grandson, yeah, for example. And so it's, you know, it's interesting that the patriarchs, you know, being so old. Now let's wrap that around and to talk about, you know, what we're finding here and who the Neanderthals were. So the Neanderthals were very close, and if the Neanderthals are actually descendants, which I believe, of Ashkenaz. Well, Ashkenaz is only the third from Japheth. So you got Japheth, you've got Gomer, then you've got Ashkenaz. Well, if you take the ages in Genesis chapter 11 for Shem's, you know, descendants, they're living 430 plus years old, mm-hmm. still, because it's only, you know, it's only 37 years after the flood. It's not that long, you know, after the flood. So they would have lived a lot longer.
So hence the findings of the furrowed brows belonging to simply old individuals.
Exactly. Uh-huh. So this type of research, for example, and stories just confirms what is actually written in the Bible, and we can take what is written there as, hey, you know what? This is not only history. This is the human history, but we know very accurately as to, you know, when Ashkenaz, you know, probably, you know, obviously it was post,
post-flood, yeah.
Post-flood, and it was after the dispersion at the Tower of Babel. So that was, you know, it was approximately 100 years after the flood that these folks started migrating up into that region.
And, of course, God had decreed at the time of the flood, as it tells us in Genesis, that the lifespan would be 120 years. I mean, he kind of reset humanity for them.
It was, and that did happen. But it was after Abraham, you know, after Abram. Mm-hmm. So it was a couple of generations further down that, you know, we get to 120. And then later in the Bible, it says, if you're a righteous man, you'll live to be 80. I mean, you'll live to be 70, but if you're righteous, you'll live to be 80. So, you know, the lifespan of man, degraded rapidly post flood. Mm-hmm. You can plot this on a graph. And the degradation in lifespan, for example, follows very, very closely the what we know about the mutation rates. And I believe we even spoke about that at some point.
We did, and so this is modern science now. And I was talking about a limited gene pool and some of the degradation to lifespan that causes. And so if we think back to the flood and 8 people in the ark, from that point in history on, lifespans dropped off precipitously in length. And so a lot of that can be traced to genealogical science or DNA.
Right. And the like I said, the human, we know what the human mutation rate is, for example, because we've got enough samples now that we know what that rate is. And this decline in ages follows that very, very well. And you know, Abram, for example, who lived to be 175, he was only about 300 years post flood. I mean, he was 300 years post flood. 292 was when he was born. Years post-flood. So we're not talking about a whole lot of time where their ages decrease from 600, for example, for Shem, down to 175 for Abram.
Well, so while Abram was alive then, there could have been still some survivors from you know, close generations in there. Some of the longer lifespans were still around.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Like,
well,
I said,
that'd be
Shem
fascinating.
Shem outlived Abram.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Selah, for example, who was the descendant of Arphaxad, who was the direct descendant from Shem, so the grandson of Shem, for example, outlived Abram himself as mm-hmm. well. So Selah lived to 21, 26, and Abram lived to 21, 23. So he didn't outlive him by much. But yeah.
So with respect to this article, then, we would essentially have to conclude that Neanderthal DNA is simply human DNA.
Exactly. It is. The other aspect of this is that, you know, the Bible talks about kinds. It doesn't talk about species. So it talks about kinds. So what's the difference between the kind and the species? Well, a kind is more related to what we would call a family. If one can mate, if you can take one animal and mate it with another animal, and you actually get, you know, progeny out of that mating.
Who can also reproduce,
then,
yeah.
Then it's of the same kind. Mm-hmm. So if you've got Neanderthal DNA, and we don't know what in this particular article, and I didn't do the research to find out, are they looking at mitochondrial DNA, and this is what we're talking about? If you have fragments or remnants of you know, Neanderthal DNA, for example, with human DNA, then, you know, they're the same kind. They're fully human, and you know, this mating was not would not be considered unusual, and they're just, you know, ancestors of modern man.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't take much imagination to just tweak the story of the standard science review of all this and make it fit the Bible, or the other way around. I mean, we're talking about the same things from two different directions here, and it just still continues to amaze me how the biblical view gets so little attention in the scientific world when it actually tends to confirm what they're finding.
Well, and this is, it is amazing because, you know, Genesis has been proven to be a historical document. This is not a fairy tale, or these are just not nice stories to tell in your Sunday school class. This is accurate history. And for us to ignore accurate history, if it was any other book, you know, believe me, they would be using it. But it's not any other book. It's the Bible. So it has the salvation message in it, and we don't want to hear about the salvation message. And so therefore, everything, you know, in the Bible is discredited. Well, the flood story itself, there are over 300 parallel, stories around the world about there was a global flood, but yet we somehow refuse to believe that the flood was global, or even such an event, occurred.
Well, even refuse to see scientific evidence that supports that view. I mean, apart from the Bible.
Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, as we've talked about many times on this program, the evidence is overwhelming. I mean, the amount of sediment that we have all around the Earth, we're talking about on an average, and of course, in the interior, there's less sediment than on the coast. but on an average, we've got 2,000 meters, or about 6,000 feet of sediment, sedimentary. You know, we call it sedimentary rock now, but it was at one point just sediment. And they're in layers, just like you would have from a catastrophe or from a tsunami or from a flood. It'd have to be a very big tsunami, of course, but, 2,000, and it's 2,000 meters, and we've got 15,000 meters on the coastlines of sediment. Well, that's 45,000 feet of sediment, of sand and small rock particles. That most of it was generated at the time of the flood, and you have absolutely no explanation as to how that got there, except that it was always there, type of thing.
Yeah, so that open ended thing, we see that a lot. We're talking with Dr. Don Clark, biochemist and member of the board at Creation Moments. And once again, if you're listening on BrokenRoadRadio.com, you can link to Creation Moments right from there. Over on the right hand side of the homepage, you'll see a little box that says Creation Moments. Click on that. It'll take you there instantly, and you'll discover just a wealth of information about young Earth creationism, and you can read it and then judge for yourself. And all I maintain is don't kill the messenger. Read what and analyze what it has to say, and tackle it from a scientific view, and then see what you think, and then make the decision for yourself. Don joins us just about every Tuesday morning, and Don, we're glad you do. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's been fun again.
Well, we'll talk to you in a week. Take care of yourself.
Okay.